Bring me sunshine. Thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this podcast from Celtic Underground. If you follow me online, I had promised to get this out on the night of the Cup Final. However, technical issues, such as me being a bit loaded up with illness. Thanks for all the sympathy. And also, if you're watching on YouTube or Spotify, you'll notice there's a bit of a glitch with the video towards the end. And so it's going out on the morning after, or the afternoon even, after the Cup Final. But it's a brilliant podcast. It's my Gaia Jordet, who literally wrote the book on penalties. So please listen to this podcast and then go back and watch everything you can about the penalties. And I think we might find Celtic have read Gaia's book. Just a gut feel, no insight from anybody, just watching this and the Cup semi-final penalties against Aberdeen. Practice does really make perfect for penalties. And if anybody says it's a lottery, they do not know what they're talking about. They're talking out their backside. Anyway, enough of me. This is free on the CelticUnderground.substack.com. And if you go on the Substack website, you can see how to link up your podcast feed if you're a paid subscriber, so you can pick it up anywhere. Everywhere else, you can pick that up anywhere. And we've got the happy tune at the beginning because the Christmas tune's at the end. Anyway, enough of me. Enjoy Gaia. I am joined now by Gaia. Now, I picked up the pronunciation, your first name, Gaia, but I'm not positive. I would just say Gaia Jordet. Is that how you pronounce it in Norwegian? That
sounds great. Very, very good, Brian. Thank you.
Happy to be here. So, yes, I'm joined by Gaia Jordet, who we will go into more detail. I will just preface this as he is a penalty expert. But we'll, as I say, we'll go into more detail. He literally has written the book on it. So I'll let you introduce yourself, talk about who you are. But the first question as part of that, I would just like to know is, when did you start watching football? And when you were growing up, who was your favourite team and what was your favourite player?
thank you. Who am I first? So I'm an academic in sports psychology, but I've done all my work on football, literally. I tried 10 years ago to publish an article on skiing, coming from Norway. Skiing is our hearts and culture. But, you know, the 10th journal had rejected it. They did not want to publish this. I realized that's not for me. So it's always been football. I'm football mad. I've always been. So when I say my work is football, it's not just academic work. I also do a lot of consulting. I work with a lot of teams. Have done that for the last 15, 20 years, not just on penalty kicks, which we will speak about now, but yes, all topics, football and psychology. And there's a lot of them in football, as you can imagine. Who was my favorite team? When did I start watching football? I started watching football when I was, like most people, like 6, 7. And this was then in the beginning of the 80s. So I think like everyone in my generation, I fell in love with the Brazilian team in the 1982 World Cup, 1986 World Cup, loved Maradona in 1986 World Cup. I'm assuming you and most of your listeners are Scottish. You'll probably be happy to know that I as you, completely adored what he did against England in the 86 World Cup. But then, I mean, in the beginning, I again, as a result of my generation, I was a Liverpool fan in the way beginning. My favorite player would be Kenny Dalglish. I've abandoned being a fan, to be honest. I was a crappy fan already back then. I moved to AC Milan when they were doing well. So I became more a fan of players, of ways to play football. I became a fan of my kind of craft in this. So I'm passionate, mad about football, but I'm no longer a fan of a particular team. But that is also professional reasons.
Yes,
you know, when you're working with teams, I'm not one of those who could work with one team and be a fan of another team. It just doesn't work like that for me. I know people operate like that, but that's how it is for me.
Well, talking of psychology, we have a number of years ago had a, just on your comment there, a positive thinking sort of guru, very big in the business world in the 90s, Scottish guy called Jack Black we've had on the podcast. And it came as a, if Jack is listening, it came as, I think I told him at the time, it came as a complete surprise to me that he was a Celtic fan. Mm-hmm. More recently I found out, because the only thing I was aware of he's worked in football is he'd worked with Rangers and Dundee United in the sort of Graeme Souness era of Rangers, which would be late 80s, early 90s, because they were so dominant in domestic football and had spent the money that at that time should have allowed them to be successful in European football, and they were just failing. And like you, I just don't know how I just could go and support one team who are the main rivals of the team I am working for. I just can't. He's obviously a stronger mental man than me in being able to do that.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. I mean, I couldn't do it, but I know people do it. But people play, people coach, and they're still fans of other teams. So it's football is I think open to different ways of doing these things.
So you said specialize in sport, and you tried to do the skiing thing, and then it's just become football. And maybe I'll ask you about the skiing thing later when I talk about psychology of football. But all through your education, were you thinking, I want to develop what I'm learning here and use it in sport or use it in football? Were you always seeing that sport and or football would be your end goal for the use of your education as you were obtaining it?
not really, I guess. I mean, I started relatively early when I was in high school, you know, and we were doing these specific papers on different topics, like I think everyone will do at one point or another. And I would always pick football topics. So I started early like that. But then I got into the university, and in the beginning, I just started that education because I was interested in football. I played football. And I had to, I signed a professional contract with a Norwegian decent team at the age of 18. Mm-hmm. But I lasted one game. Mm-hmm. And then injuries took me. And that was it. So I only got one game, actually. But
one more than most of us.
Sorry. Yeah, I know, right? but up until that point, my ambition with life was to become a football player. Mm-hmm. And now suddenly this was taken away from me, and I had to kind of put that energy somewhere, and I did put that into my studies. So I think I became probably one of the most ambitious students ever in the history of my university. I literally lived in the study hall from early morning to late night for a few years. And football was not in the beginning something that I understood, that I thought that I could make a career of. Mm-hmm. But something in sport and psychology I knew right away. And in the beginning, I had this idea of maybe working with people who had kind of fallen out of society a little bit, like drug addicts or people mm-hmm. with some serious problems. But then only after about 2 years, so I would be like around 20 at the time, I realized that football was it. And from then on, I didn't look back. It was all football, and I don't regret that.
So we can talk in general about football a wee bit later, but I want to move to one of the main aspects of what I want to talk to you about. I first stumbled across you on Twitter, and I spoke about this a wee bit off the podcast here. I have a bit of an obsession about penalties, and it comes from twofold. One, I'm a Celtic supporter, so we're all Celtic supporters listening to this, and we've not been that great in penalties in the last sort of 10 years or so, our conversion rate in penalties was, I think there was one season, Moussa Dembele was our penalty taker, and we were up in the, I think we only got four penalties and he converted all four. And so we were in the sort of 100%. But the bulk of the time, we are in that sort of mid-60s to 70% conversion rate in penalties. And that's frustrating. Now, my obsession with penalties stems from, as listeners will know, when I was young, I was a goalkeeper, never made it. But the one thing I was good at was penalties. When I was young, the very first competition I ever won was sort of 9-10 years of age. And our team won with a penalty shootout, and I saved a number of penalties because I could pick the way that the penalty shooter was going to hit it. And therefore, all the time I've been growing up, I've heard pundits, and this is a big thing about your book, I've heard pundits talking about how penalties are a lottery and all this type of stuff. And I've just permanently been thinking, no, they're not. Because if I could work it out at 9, 10, 11 and through to 16, other people can. And I have desperately been trawling the internet, trying to find something that I can get my to grips around. And then I stumble across you had one tweet, and I think it might have been during the last major finals about penalty shootouts. And that then led me to your book, which is Pressure, if anyone wants to listen to it, Lessons from the Psychology of the Penalty Shootout. So I then got into that, and it was like it was an epiphany moment. It was reading everything that I wanted to read about penalties and about how they're not a lottery and how teams have been doing them so badly and how little teams took dealing with penalties in a way that they would prepare for every other aspect of football. So this is the point when I then say, Gaia, take it away and tell the listeners, without spoiling it so much that they still buy your book, tell the listeners about what your book was, how you arrived at that book, and a lot of the sort of key findings that you came out of the book.
Yeah, okay, I'll try. that's a lot to talk about in a short time, but I mean, it's a book that I've had in me for a lot of years now. To do the personal historical bit about it before we get into the real matters here. So when I was done with my university education in sports science, sports psychology, which took 10 years, so 10 years of education, I got my first job in the Netherlands. So I spent 3 years at a Dutch university, and this was in 2004, and the Dutch, much like the English, had a big penalty trauma. They would lose every single penalty shootout they took part in. So to come to the Netherlands and be interested in football and psychology, which was my thing, I couldn't avoid this topic of penalties. But I also couldn't see anyone actually having dived into it to try to understand the psychology of a penalty kick and the penalty shootout phenomenon. Because to me, it's so psychological. It's all about pressure. It's all about dealing with emotions and stress and all these things. But no one had really gone into that. So that started a quest for me. I tell the details in the book on more exactly how I got into it. But essentially, this started as a very passionate quest to just understand this event. So what actually happens? So I spent 5 years of my life literally living, breathing, sleeping penalty kicks in football. That was all I mattered. That mattered to me. I'm so lucky that I managed to stay married after those 5 years, because, you know, I did not think of anything else. And part of that was just this passion for understanding this, but also I realized that I was onto something. And then I started getting paranoid that other people were onto the same things, because it's so obvious. It's so easy to study. Of course, no one else was doing this, so I was the only one, you know, crazy enough to dig so deep. And then this has been with me since. So I've continued to gather data on it. I've consulted with teams going into, you know, big tournaments, whether it's the World Cup or Champions League, because again, there's no one else who's really done this. And what I've done is It's very simple. I mean, I've looked a lot at the video. So every single kick in penalty shootouts in the World Cup, in the Champions League, in the European Championships, I've dissected every kick to pieces to understand every little detail that matters for performance, for dealing with stress, how you can do this individually as a team, for goalkeepers, penalty takers, everything. And although you would think of a penalty kick as a quite simple, isolated event, it's just a simple kick. There's a lot that can go into that. So that was a part of it. And then I did a lot of interviews talking with players who had taken part in these events at the highest level. And I tested a lot of these predictions that naturally would grow out of this working with these teams. A little overdue. I should have written this book 10 years ago, probably. But I got a lot into it now, I feel, just trying to document, really the psychology of a penalty kick and a penalty shootout, trying to understand that. So that's the brush, the big strokes, I guess. Yeah.
I think you perfectly encapsulate the psychology part of it right at the beginning of the book. Is it Mbappe's quote that's at the beginning of the book, where he talks? I mean, I listened to it as an audio book. And when you're listening to that quote about the pressure and the whole country on, you start to think, wow, how do you even manage to walk from the halfway line to the penalty spot with the amount of stress that your body must be under? I mean, I often go back to when Celtic played in the UEFA Cup final in 2003. I remember standing, watching that, thinking, I can hardly breathe here with my nerves and the heat. How can those players do anything out on that pitch? And I'm a million miles away from the pressure of playing it. So I think that quote at the beginning perfectly encapsulates the stress. And one of the things that comes out of it, which anecdotally as a Celtic fan rings true, Henrik Larsson, best player we've had in my life, as Lisbon Lions were around the team that won the European Cup in 67 when I was young, but I don't really remember them. In my going to Celtic for the last 50 years, Henrik Larsson's the best player. Mm-hmm. He came off penalties for Celtic because he missed too many.
Okay.
And one of the things that comes out of your book, and I don't know if you can share some stats with the listeners, one of the things that comes out of your book is some of the better players have a below average conversion rate on penalties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is there any of those sort of stats that you could share again to tease people so they buy the book?
Sure. I mean, again, this being a psychological phenomenon more than anything else, because this is what people get wrong, is that they will approach a penalty kick as a purely technical skill. A purely technical issue. And it's not. It's that too, but it's also mostly about how do you deal with the stress of this moment. So one would think then that the best players are the best penalty takers, naturally. But if you look at at a player like Messi, and I have a sub-chapter in the book, I think I called it the Messi problem. Mm-hmm. 'Cause Messi has taken, 150 plus penalties in his career, something like that. But his stats is clearly below average as a penalty taker. The best penalty taker of our generation, no, the best football player of our generation, and surely the most technically gifted player, is just a below average penalty taker. And that is, of course, interesting. And the reason that there could be many reasons for that, but one of them is that it's not just about the quality of the kick or your foot. It's about how do you deal with this specific moment. And if you are a superstar the size of Messi, if you are, or even like Henrik Larsson, relatively speaking, back in the day, that comes with more expectations. The status that you have come with extra pressure. And in fact, to answer your question specifically about the stats, when we do a study on, so how do these superstars perform with their penalties compared to other regular elite players, we find that the superstars perform about 15% lower than the regular penalty taker. And most likely that comes because just the pressure is just so much higher on them. If one player should really deliver, it's Messi or even Henrik Larsson. And that pressure could just be too much to handle for some of these guys.
One of the things you talked about, your studies are not just about penalties, it's about the psychology in football at all, completely. And one of the things that jumps out from the book is that football hasn't really bought into psychology of sport yet. So why do you think that is, when actually I would say one of the key things in the 21st century across all sports is to hear much more about the mind in sport. So why do you think football is so reticent and so late to the party?
Yeah, great question. And I wish I had a perfect answer to that, which I don't, because this I'm curious about myself. Because football hasn't figured out psychology, and we think that we are on the path, but we've been thinking that for now 10, 15 years. I use a quote often from Arsene Wenger that he delivered in, I think, 2009, where he talked about how in football now, up until that point, we had made so great strides in the physical area and the technical area, mm-hmm. and the tactical area as well. Which was true, because, you know, analytics came along, physical training, fitness trainers came along, and we've done so well on that. And then he said in 2009 that the next 10 to 15 years will be all about the mind, about the brain. We'll make huge progress in the mental area. And we have certainly seen more interest in the mental area, but in reality, we have not made much strides at all. And that I do know a little bit about, because I travel a lot to clubs and teams all over Europe constantly. And there's more interest, there's more curiosity, but there's not a structured approach to dealing with this. Yes, we have a little bit more, maybe it's called mental coaches, sports psychologists, mm-hmm. But they're not fully embedded or integrated in the team, because football doesn't know exactly how to do that. And to then try to answer your question, I think in football, we're still a little bit too traditionalist. We're a little conservative. We are the most conservative sport in the world. I think most people would agree, which makes sense to a large extent, because also football is so popular and there's so many people who want to get something from football or be a part of football, and they want to sell something to football. So people in football become naturally, and I think also in many ways healthy, skeptics, because they don't want to jump on anything new that's kind of shiny and promises a lot of results. But that also becomes an obstacle for football, that you're not really embracing some of these innovations that probably would give better results if you took them on, and psychology would be one of those. So yeah, there are many reasons, and it's a big question.
Do you think, I wondered when I was listening, whether certainly, and I could see this in the UK, where historically the head coach has been the manager who's been in charge of everything, and his job is to be the motivator, the famous Alec Ferguson hairdryer treatment at halftime, where do you think there's an element of the head coaches and managers are reluctant that key element of there's two sort of key elements of their job, tactics and motivation of the team? Do you think part of it might be that they perceive getting someone like yourself in, for example, to talk about the psychology of various aspects of it, would feel to them as if they were giving away some of their power? Because they would be ceding the motivational side of things as they see it to an outside party. Do you think that could be part of it?
It could be, and there could be multiple sides to that. Because so one could be give away kind of power and influence as almost like an ego thing for the head coach, for the manager. I can see some cases where that would be the case. And in others, I think managers would be reluctant to also get a voice too close to the players that does not come from football. Mm-hmm. That is maybe too much of an outsider's perspective. That might also not just not help a player, but also maybe even put the wrong thoughts into a player's head. And honestly, I can understand that because this is complicated. It's not simple. In reality, what the approach that I think is the best approach to integrate psychology in football is actually through the coaches, not just the manager, but through the assistant coaches and through the staff that is already around the team, working with them every day. Often, I think the best approach to integrate psychology in football is to educate that population to communicate psychology in a competent manner, and that is better than to bring in a specialist who knows nothing about football but a lot about the mind.
Yeah.
Who honestly can do as much harm as good sometimes. So I get that perspective. But if a manager uses this perspective to stop any kind of progress on this or any kind of new ideas coming into to his team, then of course this is wrong.
So if we get back on to penalties, because this leads to a comment you just made there about football being quite conservative. One of the things, again, that really jumped out at me is having a pre-penalty routine, for want of a better way of putting it, for the penalty takers. And I use that terminology because, obviously, being in Scotland, golf's quite a big sport. Golf is pretty famous for quite some time now. Professional golfers will have a pre-shot routine. They will have a routine because they can, for putts, a putt, for example. Well, you can't replicate holding a 10-foot putt, the pressure of holding a 10-foot putt to win the Open Championship and win millions of pounds. But it's well accepted, the concept of, yes, but if they practice 10-foot putts enough, they're at least taking control of some of it. Mm. And it's clear from when I was listening that's what football hasn't bought into. And it's the big thing that you, when you do engage with teams, that you do try to instill is some sort of routine in it. And it is almost comical when you describe the, I mean, we all remember them, everybody listening to this will remember them, the sort of penalties that were taken last century, the way that people would be rushing to get the penalty over as quickly as possible and no sort of routine at all. So again, do you want to sort of talk about that? For me, everything you're describing is about the penalty taker taking control, as much control of the situation as possible.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And historically, I mean, penalties got into football like big with the penalty shootouts that started in the early 1970s. And watching those penalty shootouts from the 70s and the 80s is so entertaining for many reasons. One of them being how these players were just victims of the situation. They did not take any type of control. There was nothing deliberate about how they stepped up to the ball. It seemed like what they all wanted to do was just get in and get out again as soon as possible. It almost seemed as if it didn't matter if they scored or not. It was more important to just get away from the discomfort as soon as they could. And you can tell that you can see that quite easily. And this is how we've measured some of these things. When the penalty taker puts the ball on the spot, steps back, the referee will blow his whistle. And then how long does it take before the penalty taker then starts to run towards the ball? In the 70s and in the 80s, the average time the penalty taker would wait after the whistle was less than half a second. Less than half a second. Which means, you know, some of them couldn't even wait for the whistle. So they would start to run almost before the whistle had been blown. And if you look, and it's absurd if you use the same type of thinking for other sports, like a golf player, It's not about hitting the golf ball as soon as you can. Or for a rugby player, it's not about taking that kick as soon as you can, but that's how it was in football. And when you look at the stats on it, and of course we did that, and I published these studies first around 2008-2009, we found very clear correlations. First, we found correlations that the higher the pressure, the higher the stress in this moment, measured in different ways, the quicker the penalty taker. The sooner they step towards the ball after the whistle had gone. And the other part of it, the quicker you are, the worse your performance. Very clear correlations that we found back then. Now, since then, of course, these findings have been communicated. They were published in scientific journals. A lot of media would pick this up already back then. And now we've seen a very interesting trend because players are taking more and more time. So from about 2010, where I think until 2010, the average time that players would take after the whistle was just below 1 second. In the Premier League last year, the average time was 3.5 seconds. So we see this all over, that football players are now embracing a completely new mindset and approach to a penalty kick, where just like you say, they do as golfers have done for decades, and they're just a little bit more deliberate with their routine. It's a little bit more planned what to do, and as a result, they have more control over themselves and over the situation. And this, I think, is a very, very positive development.
But it's not just the player that this was the other thing that. So Celtic, I talked about Celtic's penalty record not being so great. But this season, I think Celtic have had 5 penalties and have scored them all. One by Arnott Engels and one by, sorry, 4 by Arnott Engels and one by Adam Ida. Interestingly, last season after I think we did 4 penalties and missed 2 and scored 2 in a game. And one of them was after a game where we'd drawn the game, and Brendan Rodgers said, "We are leaving too many goals out there on the pitch, and penalties is definitely something we are going to have to start considering." Because being an attacking team that's playing the front foot in domestic football, we're in the opposition's box, so we should get more penalties as a consequence of that. Then if we get somewhere in the region of 7 to 12 penalties in a season domestically, and we... 2 goals below the average, well, those 2 goals could be in games where we end up drawing, and so that's 4 points. Mm. And since he made that statement, and since I've read your book or listened to your book, I have noticed that it's not just our players. There is a routine. So, for example, Arnott Engels' first penalty, he just signed for Celtic, our most expensive player. He's only 21. We're playing against Hearts. Hearts players, there's a pitchside camera where you can pick up the Hearts players talking about £10 million player, waste of money. They're shouting all this at him. Mm-hmm. He went, as a supporter, it wasn't clear he was taking the penalty because Callum McGregor, the captain, went and picked the ball up. He was at the edge of the box, and I thought it was actually Rio Hitati who was taking the penalty. Engels takes it. He's not there at the. So do you want to? And then we lost a penalty. Another aspect of things, we lost a penalty, a game against Ross County, and the camera picked up Kasper Schmeichel roughing up the penalty spot prior to their penalty. So do you want to talk through how that penalty routine isn't all down to the guy taking the kick?
Yes. So that's. These are all really good examples, and also something that I feel has become a little bit of a trend these past few years, and I'm sure I've contributed to it too, because I've written about it, but I've also tweeted quite extensively about this and put it out on social media over these last few years, and I've noticed that a lot of teams now do these things, and like first, like you say, that McGregor is taking the ball, and you kind of think that he's the one that will take the penalty, but it's not. It's someone else. Now, of course, that's a very deliberate strategy to draw attention away from the real penalty taker, which will make it possible for the real penalty taker to prepare his penalty and his kick, and to think about what he's going to do in the periphery of the chaos that often erupts around the penalty spot and around the person the opposing team think is the penalty taker. And what this essentially is an attempt to basically stop the opponents from getting into your head, to stop the opponents from distracting, disturbing too much. And it makes a penalty kick into something that most people probably wouldn't think it is. It makes it into a team performance. So a penalty kick is, in my opinion, not an individual performance. It's a collective performance. Yes, there's an individual whose foot will be the last one to touch the ball. But a penalty kick is all about what leads up to that. The moment the foot hits the ball is just the tip of the iceberg. It's the final step of a series of steps. Just like you say, it's about the individual taker. It's about the routine, getting into the proper mindset, keeping confident, keeping focused, composed, all these things. But to get there, you need help. And you don't get the help from the opponents, because they obviously will do whatever they can to disturb you. But you can get that help from your teammates. So that's why we see the decoy penalty taker, like with McGregor. We see the penalty taker bodyguards, which is necessary in the game in 2024. Basically, teammates who are keeping opponents away from the penalty taker, not getting that, letting them come close. And you even see penalty spot protectors to make sure that the opponents don't scuff up the penalty spot. And these people are critical for the outcome of that individual penalty kick. And this, of course, makes the study and the practice of penalty kicks even just so much more interesting, because it's not just that simple kick on the ball. It's the whole game around it, which of course, is fascinating.
And the other aspect of that, I mean, so we saw that again, talked about McGregor getting the ball, Callum McGregor got the ball. We also had one of our centre-halves, Liam Scales. He stood on the penalty spot, and I really noticed that there was a game in the 10th minute of injury time with all the added time where a decision had gone to VAR. Now, we didn't get the penalty. The VAR didn't rule it, and the referee just blew for full time. But the thing a corner had been given, and the thing I really noticed, although the corner had been given, because the referee had gone to VAR, somebody went and got the ball and stood. The penalty taker stood out of the box, and a Celtic player went and stood on the penalty spot in that situation. They were prepping for the event of a VAR decision, even though the corner had been given. And as I say, it didn't happen. I really saw that we've obviously bought into some of the ideas that you've been saying with our penalties.
Yeah, and this is, and it's so logical to do these things, because if you accept the premise that a penalty kick is not just a technical skill, it's also about dealing with the moment, the stress and the pressure, which really it is, then you have to do these things. So this to me is being professional in the game in 2024. This is doing what it takes to increase the probability of us getting a goal on what, of course, is a big chance to score a goal, but still, not all teams are doing this. I would say maybe half of the teams at the highest level they're doing something like this, but still many are not. So there's still a competitive advantage for those teams who are embracing these parts of it. And I've seen some of Celtic's penalties myself, and I've seen, you know, some of these things you speak about, but I also see it just in the way that these individual penalty takers are lining up their shots, how they go through a routine before their kicks. There's a little weight, there's a little breath. It's a very clear and deliberate walking back from the ball and walking up to the ball. And that, those little hints of information tell me that this is a team they're doing this on purpose. There is a plan. There is a routine. There's something that has been rehearsed. That doesn't mean that Celtic will make every single penalty they get. My apologies for having to say this. That's not necessarily the case, but it will for sure increase the probability so that more goals will be scored when they make sure that they do those steps leading up to the kick right.
On that as well, one of the things you explain quite well in the book is goalkeeper-dependent penalty methods and goalkeeper non-dependent penalty methods. The goalkeeper-dependent penalty method, to me, requires an exceptional level of calmness from the penalty taker and skill, because you are, forgive me if I'm interpreting it wrong, you are effectively making a decision as to where you're hitting it in the last second, half second before you hit the ball. That's an incredible judgment. So do you want to talk through that methodology?
Yeah, so the goalkeeper dependent method of taking a kick is basically just that you step up to the ball and you haven't decided where to shoot it, because you first look at the goalkeeper and let the goalkeeper make the first move to left or right. If the goalkeeper moves to the left, you basically roll the ball to the right and vice versa. So this is a method that has been around for many, many years. I mentioned Diego Maradona in the 80s. He used to use this method, very skillfully so. And there are others, top players who have done this. But this method has seen an increase over the past years, the past decade, but also even more the past 3-4 years. And I think a reason for that is that the alternative approach, the goalkeeper independent method, would be the classical approach that you step up to the ball, you've decided where to shoot. I'm going to go left and I'm going to go with power maybe, and then you just go left. So very simple. Just make sure that you get it probably as close to the post as you can so that it's outside of the goalkeeper's reach. Now, statistically, if you use that method and the goalkeeper goes to the right, in the right direction, to basically try to save your shot, the goalkeeper will have almost a 50% chance of stopping that shot. If the goalkeeper goes in the wrong direction, then you have you will score like on 9 out of 10 shots. Point is, something that you cannot control as a penalty taker, if the goalkeeper goes to the right direction or to the wrong direction, has a very big impact on the outcome of your shot. And for some players, they can't live with those odds. So then they don't like, and I get that, the prospect of something I cannot control will have so much influence on my penalty kick. Of course, you can all, if you put your ball to the top corner of the net, it's going to be hard for any goalkeeper to score. But that is also a very hard shot to make under pressure. So with that said, some players then go for this goalkeeper-dependent approach where they have full control. Because if the goalkeeper goes right, I put it left and vice versa. But like you say, it's a very hard skill to master, because that means that maybe with 60,000 people on the stands and a few million watching at home, pressure is truly on. It's all down to this shot. You step up to the ball, you lift your foot to kick the ball, and you still have not decided where to shoot it. Now that requires a calm mind. And this situation had enough pressure to begin with. So the players who are able to execute this well, they're very competent at it. Think Robert Lewandowski for Barcelona and Poland. Think Ivan Toney. They use this method and they do it really, really well. But it requires a whole lot to do it well. So it's not for the faint-hearted, I'll tell you that.
One of the things that struck me about that was, with VAR, there's a greater analysis of whether keepers are moving off the line, which is, again, forgive me if I'm wrong, but it's something like conversion rate in the English Premiership since VAR's come in and monitored goalkeepers has gone from something like 79% to 86% or something in those regions for scoring, because the keeper's having to move later. Surely that then makes the keeper-dependent method even harder if keepers are now trying to wait to the very last second because they can't move off the line because of the VAR analysis. And I just think, what happens is, as you said, you swing your foot back and the keeper hasn't made a movement, your foot's going to have to follow through. You're going to have to make a decision.
Yes. So you need a plan B. Because sometimes, and that is the case, and this will be the case more and more and more, because, you know, up until very recently, goalkeepers would analyze the penalty takers, and they will look at one thing: does he shoot left or does he shoot right? But now you have to look at their technique as well. You have to know, is the penalty taker actually looking at me? Because if he's looking at me, I should not be moving early off the line or on the line, because of course they can move on the line and go relatively early on the line. So that is a critical part for this kind of dynamic between the penalty taker and the goalkeeper going forward. And we see now that goalkeepers are also playing tricks with goalkeeper dependent penalty takers, where they will either stand very late to force that plan B to happen, or they will make these really believable dummy moves. And some of them have practiced this. It's so subtle and it's so skillful how you would be convinced that the goalkeeper was headed to the left, but then they switch in the very last fraction of a second and they go right. And this is, for example, how Italy did not qualify for the 2022 World Cup, because Sommer for Switzerland, he tricked Jorginho, Italy's penalty taker, now with Arsenal, then at Chelsea, into going the wrong way with his goalkeeper-dependent kick. And penalty takers who are using this technique, they're terrified of this. So what you then see, just to finish the whole argument on this, although, you know, there's a lot more about this, of course, in the book, is that you see the real specialists now, they alternate method. Robert Lewandowski, who has always been goalkeeper dependent, he's now putting in goalkeeper independent kicks, where he has a completely different technique. Whereas Harry Kane has gone the other way. He was always goalkeeper independent, and now he alternates that with goalkeeper dependent. And then you become very difficult for the goalkeepers to read. There's still ways to read them, though, and you have to check out the book to see.
So we've talked about penalty takers and looking at the time. So I just want to cover off two quick things. One will be the penalty shootout itself, which is the largest part of the book. But being a former young goalkeeper myself, I want to talk about the goalkeeper's role. So, for example, we had Craig Gordon, who played for Celtic and plays for Scotland and now plays at Hearts, has a dreadful penalty record. I remember when he was at Celtic at one point looking up the stats on Transfer Market, and it was something like he'd faced 33 penalties in his professional career at that stage. One had hit the post, one had gone past the post, and one he'd saved, and the other 30 had all, and the other 30 had gone in. And I used to think, why doesn't he just always just go the same way? I mean, at least he'll have a chance of getting it, because he patently is. Opposite way, we had also had Fraser Foster, who had a great record for us at saving penalties. One of the things I always felt with Fraser Foster was he was 6'7" and filled the goal. And I used to think sometimes just the intimidation of a huge figure filling the goal would make players, like we had Rab Douglas, who was before him, who had a record of people missing against Rab Douglas. And I always felt his size made players want to put the ball just a wee bit further away from him, and consequently they would miss. They would put it past the post or over the bar. So what's the skill set that keepers need to have, particularly these days where it is more difficult? I mean, so I mentioned that one, Kasper Schmeichel roughed up the penalty spot. He saved the penalty, and VAR spotted he'd come off his line marginally, and he had to retake it, and he didn't save it. So what are the skill sets for referees today? Goalkeepers today.
For goalkeepers, yeah. No, of course, there are a lot of different variations of skill that would go into stopping a penalty kick as well. Starting with the basics, I mean, the size of a goalkeeper will matter, because the reach you have when you're making a saving attempt will matter. If you're able to, if you start your dive at a reasonable time to actually get over to the post when the ball hits it, of course that's gonna increase your chances of saving a penalty. So your physique, your reach, but of course also your technique your ability to make that jump so quickly and so skillfully that you can make it, your ability to have a firm stopping stance so you can actually be strong enough on the ball when it comes, so it doesn't just deflect on you and go into the goal, but actually goes out. Your eye, your reaction time, these types of things will also help with that. And then, of course, also like you would speak about in your youth, reading the penalty taker and be able to actually anticipate where that shot will be taken.
Yeah, on the reading, it was very simplistic. I was playing against simple people. People with an angled run, if they were right-footed, and they were running with an angle, would hit it to my right. People with a straight run would hit it to my left. Very basically.
Sure, but sufficient, and these things will still work. But it's more sophisticated at the highest level because the penalty takers now will be a little bit more aware that they will be red, so they will put in little precautions if you want. So I think now that type of skill is also related to how you work with video beforehand. And like I mentioned, it's not just about does the penalty taker go left or right. It's about how does he do that. And the really good goalkeepers and the goalkeeper coaches, they will also spend time on studying the exact run-ups, the exact angles, to basically decipher some of these movements in the actual game. So there are a lot of these types of things that matter. Now, what I spend time on in the book, I happen to be fascinated with that part of the game and of a penalty kick is how goalkeepers can kind of creep into the mind of the penalty takers, how they can disrupt them, disturb them, how they can get them off balance, destabilize them, essentially, both cognitively and emotionally. And I have a whole chapter on that in the book where I'm listing all kinds of strategies and seeing what some of the best at this craft is doing. People like Emi Martinez, of course, it's very hard to get away from him, who really has won the World Cup for Argentina almost single-handedly, it seemed. Of course, Messi played a part as well, and there were other skillful players there. But the way he took control in these penalty shootouts, and I think he has now, what is it, 5 penalty shootouts in a row? For club and country that he has won, because he just dominates this event. He's so creative, he's so shameless, he's so substantial in the way that he does this, and he plays the game so well, because it's not just about doing all kinds of crazy things to get the penalty taker off balance, it's also getting away with it, because there's a referee there who will try to stop you from doing too much of this. But some of these players, some of these goalkeepers, they do this so well, and he's one of the best.
So one thing, just as you were talking there, I wonder if football would ever move this far. So I also like my cricket, and for spin bowlers, it's all about the hand, and you have to be able to pick it up from 22 yards away. So it's very last second. They've even had a situation where what they've done is batsmen to practice, they've had a screen with the run-up of a bowler, and then they have a bowling machine that fires the ball so that if the guy's spinning one way or the other, so that to help players read the spin bowler and how the ball's going to be, so that they're getting used to that. You might say, actually, some clubs are already doing that, but I was going to say, can you see that type of thing coming into football where they're analysing and it's a full-scale screen of penalty takers watching goalkeepers to see how they're going to be and goalkeepers watching penalty takers and then getting the ball to fly out?
Absolutely. And now, honestly, I don't know anyone who has taken this type of technology and analysis all the way when it comes to a detail such as penalty kicks. But I do know that more and more clubs are using technology such as virtual reality, such as 360 degree screens that basically, you know, encapsulate the player within the center that you get the whole game around you. I know clubs are considering using things such as holograms, which will essentially just place a projection of a player in front of you. So the technology is now there. What I've seen in terms of how this has been used, it's not good enough yet for it to be effective. But it's just a matter of time before these things will be so good that they will matter, and they will impact these players, and they will impact results in football. And I think this is, part of the future when it comes to our game, like it or not.
So one other thing, again, I'm going to go into a massive topic and give you a couple of minutes to give an answer, but that's why people need to read the book, is a large chunk of the book, the penalty shootout. And again, there's lots of chat in that about that whole thing that we're now all familiar with the players at the halfway line, linking arms and round the shoulder. And you talk about how some of that can become a negative. The other thing that never occurred to me until your book was they don't need to stand at the halfway line. They could stand somewhere else. And again, thinking back after listening to your book to our Scottish Cup semi-final penalty shootout against Aberdeen last season, we had a penalty shootout. And one of the things I remember is only the players involved in the penalty shootout came together at the end of the game. And a member of the sort of peripheral element of the coaching team went to come and speak to somebody in that. And I remember Brendan Rodgers chasing them away and getting quite angry with them. And then reading your book, it hits home why that would be the case. And as I say, Joe Hart took the fourth penalty, I think it was, and missed it. He hit the post. I'm always sympathetic when a player hits the post at the penalty, because I always think he was, you know, millimetres away from actually the perfect penalty because it was right in the corner. So I'm a bit more sympathetic to that. One, it was really unusual that a goalkeeper stood up to take it, but apparently they'd been practicing penalties and he had scored one every week, and Brendan Rodgers has said, you know, if it came to one in the final, he would be playing in that too. So again, that sort of whole bonded together and how people operate in the penalty shootout, do you want to have a wee 5 minutes on that?
Yeah, I'm glad for the time restriction, because I could talk about that for, I think, a few hours.
Yeah, well, there's a few chapters on it.
Yes, there are a few chapters on it. Because now we're moving into more of the intricacies of the social psychology around a penalty shootout. And it's so fascinating, because even though the penalty shootout has been around now for more than 50 years, there's still so many traditions. I mean, we spoke about football as a conservative sport, and that's also seen in the penalty shootout. For example, just that single detail that you mentioned, everyone now is standing on the halfway line when there's a penalty shootout. So the teams are standing there. Now the rules say that you have to stay within the circle, so you don't have to stand on the line. You can stand actually 7, 8, 10 yards in front of the line, which would be the logical place to stand, because you want to stand as close to the action as possible. You want to stand as close to the penalty spot as you can. But they choose to not do that. They choose to stand further back because the line is there. And the line is, I guess it's very indicative of this is where you should be standing. Yep. Here is even the line. But I've seen now teams have gotten a little bit more creative with it, because you need to ask the question, why are we standing the way we're standing? Why are we positioning like this? What's the function of this? And is there a dysfunction of it? And the dysfunction of standing together as a team like that, which, I mean, initially was done because you want to kind of show that you're a team, you want to show team spirit and cohesion and all these wonderful things. But the problem, and we see that quite often, is when one of your teammates is missing a shot, and to me, most cruelly, for example, when England was in the European Championships final in 2021 and they missed a few shots, and there's a picture that I have in my book of Marcus Rashford when he missed the first shot for England. So now he has to walk, what is it, 40, 50 yards mm-hmm. back to his team alone. And if you think the walk from the mid-circle to the penalty spot is a lonely walk, I can promise you that the walk from the spot to the mid-circle after you have missed a shot, that is lonelier. And he walked those 40 yards alone with not a single English player coming to greet him, basically making the walk shorter or even just doing anything to indicate that even if you miss that shot, you're still a part of our group. And that is dreadful to watch. Now, fortunately, England, or fortunately for England, they did something different in the last Euros. They didn't stand together with their hands interlocked. They had loosened up that formation so that they could be more agile. And this sounds, you know, way too much, but they were agile in the sense that every single penalty taker had a buddy in the squad that would had a responsibility to come and meet that penalty taker after the shot was taken. So they created a structure around how we're supporting each other in this moment. And if we try to draw out the principle of that, why do they actually do that? Well, we know from a lot of research that under severe pressure and stress, if you can feel connected to your team, if you can feel belonging to your team, if you feel safe in your team, in your group, with the people that you're performing with, then your chances of performing better just goes up so much. And anything that you can do in this situation to create that, or to dial the volume up on connection, will be beneficial. But if you're not doing this deliberately, and if you don't have a plan around this, you're not going to get there. So that's the mid-circle and everything having to do with the coaching part of this. And that's another chapter in the book. I talk about as a coach, as a manager, I mean, with the penalty shootout, you have 2 minutes or 3 minutes maybe to impact your team after extra time is over until they're probably taking the most important single kicks in their careers. And now it becomes interesting, what do you say in those 3 minutes? What do you do in those 3 minutes? And some of these teams are, you know, it looked like they just landed on the moon. They have no idea what they're going to do. They have no idea what to say. Whereas other teams, they have a plan, they have a structure, like Brendan Rodgers would do. Only the people who have a role will be around this team. Only the people who actually have something to say will be here. The others will probably just cause more chaos and more noise. So we're not going to have them here because you have to approach this in a professional manner. And that is also about how we conduct ourselves as a team and how we communicate, who communicates, and so forth. There's so much more going into that. But this is just about taking that part of the game that we know doesn't happen all the time. But when it happens, it's so decisive for the outcome of the game. You have to approach this part in a professional manner. And I'm so happy that some of these teams are finally doing that.
Well, excuse me. It was it's a brilliant book. I can't recommend it highly enough to people who have an obsession with football. Excuse me. Because, one, it really reinforces that psychology is such an essential part. When you get to an elite level, another book that I often talk on here about is Soccernomics, and another one, Football by Numbers, and they talk about a centre-half in the fourth tier of English football has virtually the same pass completion rate when under no pressure as a centre-half playing for a top Premiership team. Put them under pressure, everybody's pass completion rate falls off, but a fourth-tier player falls off a cliff. Because it's the psychology of being under pressure. And you just focus that down into the psychology. And there's so much that you talk about. And I know I'm sounding like some massive salesman for your book, but there's so much that you talk about that is, I was listening to it, I was thinking, of course that makes perfect sense, particularly around the whole thing about how people behave in the penalty shootout and that whole thing about bonding and the break away from, you're always being ripped out of the group of people who are then, you leave it and they all bond back together and grip, you're this lonely, isolated figure going off.
It's very logical. And that's because also, I mean, they're football players and they're paid an insane salary every week and all these things, but they're also humans.
Yeah.
They're people. And people respond to stress and pressure in very universal ways. So you could also actually say that this book, although it's about football, it's about penalty shootouts, but it's about people under pressure, because these are mechanisms that we all will recognize. And I mean, I sometimes talk about the book and I would say that it's really about the penalty kicks that we each have in our own lives, because it's the same type of process and you will always recognize it, because it's really about you and I, and not just that penalty kick. It's about how we as people deal with pressure and how we don't deal with pressure and what we can do to get better at it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you know, from a business perspective, that I thought was quite interesting was your point about people quite like an element of democracy in business and decision-making, but when it comes to stressful moments, people want one person who's the leader who says, we're going to do this, 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 and this, and they all, and most people are sitting going, they want somebody to be that person who says, right, this is what we're doing. And that's why clear messaging at penalties work. But you can take that into anybody listening to this, can then think about their daily work and think of those situations where it's nice to share decision making, but at key moments you just want someone to go, no, we're doing this, 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 this.
Yes. And yet in football for so many years, they turn it upside down. They might be very clear and directive and non-democratic throughout the whole year, and then they get to a penalty shootout and suddenly they start asking, so who wants to take a penalty kick? Which is the other way around, which breeds then insecurity and lack of confidence and more anxiety, because our leader does not even know what we're going to do. So it's about turning it upside down. Be democratic in general.
Yeah.
But when you get to a penalty shootout, when you get to a decisive situation, then you're going to look to the leader to give us directions on what to do. And it's the same in football as in life.
Excellent. Well, your book is Pressure, Lessons from the sort of subheading, Lessons from the Psychology of the Penalty Shootout. People can buy it and they can listen to it. I listened to it on the Apple Bookstore. And I have to say, it's narrated by you, which I always think makes it better when it's narrated by the author. And again, I watched Arnott Engels, Celtic player at 21 years of age, hold a press conference in English, in full, prior to Celtic playing Red Bull Leipzig. And he also answered a question in German, but he's Belgian. And so I'm always very impressed that we are such a terrible country for not learning languages. And there's you reading a whole book out in English. And you've done this whole podcast in English. So thank you very much for that. And people can follow you on Twitter. Where are you on Twitter?
Yeah, so just my name, Guy Jordet on Twitter. So, yeah, I put out things on this and other football psychology topics.
Excellent. Well, with that, I'll see Guy as your date. Thanks very much.
Says that unless there is a substantial increase in the present war effort in Vietnam, the U.S. should look forward to five more years of war. In a speech before the Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in New York, Nixon also said opposition to the war in this country is the greatest single weapon working against the U.S. That's the 7 o'clock edition of the news. Good night.